you're not like a super money driven person.
No, I'm very driven just to make things. I have that internal drive within. Like, I'm always doing something. I'm always making things and have a plan for the next thing.
Do you have like a set day off where you're like, I'm not touching a mug today?
No. I mean, no. Sometimes, you know, we'll try to make plans and do something and then I'm not in the studio, of course. But if nothing's happening, why don't I come up here? It's, you know, it's a great place to be. So
you just really love what I love what doing.
I love what I do. I mean, people pay money to do pottery. So
that's true. That's
I make money doing pottery. Yeah. It's a pretty good balance, so.
Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, Meredith?
Hi, I'm Meredith Chernick. I am the potter at Fern Street Pottery, and I have created a home studio and a full-time business for myself doing pottery.
Cool. So we met back in Seattle, and well, I guess you technically don't live in Seattle, but we met back there. And
Seattle-ish.
Seattle-ish. And I saw your studio and I got to spend some time with you, and you kind of have like, I guess what I would say is maybe like the, like a dream scenario going on with like you make pottery in a treehouse in the forest. So can you elaborate a little bit on that?
It's pretty crazy good. So my studio is in my backyard, and it's built over the garage, which is, so it's like the carriage house, mother-in-law kind of space, but it's, so it's the size of a two-car garage. And when we moved in, there was nothing here, and my husband and I definitely saw the potential, and we built it in ourselves. You know, we, mostly him. And so by us building it, of course, we were able to save tons of money too. And you know, if I had to hire someone to build my studio for me, that would have been, you know, I don't know, a big chunk that we couldn't have done. So, you know, having my husband able to create things and build space has been just a huge, huge help. So the space is, like I said, it's over my garage. I'm looking out the window right now. And like you said, it's a treehouse environment. I live in a very small town, across the water across the Puget Sound from Seattle. It's a ferry ride away, and really small town. Very, very idyllic setting. It feels like you've gone back in time when you get here. And it's great. Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect place for a potter. And then plus I'm near the city, so I'm near suppliers and, you know, galleries, etc. So it's pretty ideal.
So I want to go back in time a little bit. I know your background, obviously, that you're a teacher and all this, but let's go back to the beginning. What got you interested in pottery, and what were you doing before you decided to go on your own and open your own business?
Well, I've been doing pottery since I was a small child, and taking lessons at the parks department and other museums and other places since I was six. So I've always done pottery. It's just, it's in my nature. It's a way of thinking for me. And so when I went away to school, I thought, well, I might want to be a teacher. I might, you know, want to continue to do pottery, but how can you actually be and, you know, support yourself being an artist and even supporting yourself being a teacher? I thought it sounded challenging.
It's part of what I'm trying to accomplish with this show, actually, is that how can you make money as an artist?
How do you make it work? Well, so I went into teaching, focused on art and pottery specifically, but K-12 all art specialist. I did that for a little while, and then I ended up teaching in a very small private art school, which is out here near my home, and a private college. So that was really fun because I really, really enjoyed working with the older kids. I did that for almost 20 years, and it was definitely like what I meant to do, what I love to do. I think of myself as a teacher. That's my identity. I love teaching. Until after 19 and a half years I just was, I was just kind of done, ready to be done. And I feel like I had put all that energy out there and I needed to use some of my own energy on myself and my own work. So what I did at that point was, we were starting to build this studio here. It wasn't quite finished, and it was like halfway done and really very ghetto in the back. And I just started doing a little bit of pottery in the back room, which is what's now the back room. And I started teaching some neighborhood kids just to kind of get it going and to use the space and get word out there. And then, so I did that for a couple, it was summertime. I did that in the summers, and then I was still teaching. And then it started to grow and grow. And I started to be, feel like I was done with teaching more and more when I was still at the college. And so I think the fact that I sort of processed into it slowly, it worked out really well and enabled me to build the studio, the rest of the studio out with the money I made from teaching classes here. And then it kind of grew, and then people were like, oh, will you make me some mugs? Will you make these for my store? You know, so I didn't have to beat the pavement too much because people sort of knew I was out here. And, you know, small town living, word spreads. So that's sort of how it started. It was pretty fluid the way it started, and my change from, you know, 20 years of teaching into running my studio. So I was doing the kids classes here, and then it got to a point where I just didn't have enough time and space to do the kids classes, and it was just my work. And
when you say kids, like how old were these kids?
Neighborhood kids. So let's see, I think I had a teen class, and I had a couple of gosh, I don't recall. They were the ages of my kids because that's who we knew. Mm-hmm. So they were probably like 10, 12, 13. And then I had an older kids class. You know, I think I did it for a couple of years. I did do a mom's cocktail hour class with my, you know, a lot of friends and neighbors. And that was super fun. You know,
so what made you, like, I guess what made you feel comfortable to stop the teaching and just go full time basically?
So leaving the school where I taught
yeah, because at first you were kind of doing it like simultaneously, like, or
yeah,
can't say that word, but yeah.
I was kind of doing everything, which as an artist I think is not uncommon. So let's see, how did it work out? I guess I was building up my own practice and starting to apply to things, to shows and galleries and things. So, and I was still at the college where I taught, NCAD, at this point. And I got accepted into a pretty prestigious show, which I applied to thinking, I'm never going to get in. It's going to take me 6-8 years to apply, and maybe then I'll get in. I don't know why I had that in my mind, but that was what I had decided. And so I thought, well, then I better start applying. So I applied and I got in and I was blown away. and so that was, I think, a catalyst for me leaving the college where I was teaching, because I had to make enough pottery to sell at this fair. And as I said, I was just kind of, you know, 20 years is a long time in the same place to teach.
Yes.
And I was just kind of, you know, wearing out of it. So I loved it still. I would say that I was a less inspired teacher than I had been, and I didn't want to be that person. I didn't want to be a not inspired teacher, because that's not inspiring. So I felt like it was time for me to move on.
So I guess let's talk about the numbers, because that is like an important aspect of all this, is and just like you deciding that you're making enough money to leave the teaching. So as a teacher, like, if you had to estimate, give or take, like, I assume you got like pay bumps over the course of like 20 years, but just ballpark, like, what was it that you were making?
So I don't recall what my hourly rate was. I think the hourly rate was pretty decent, but I just didn't have that many on the clock hours. All the teachers were part-time. And so I'd say my annual, I want to say when I left, and I had, like I said, I've been there almost 20 years. When I left, I think my annual income was about $22,000.
Okay.
As a part-time instructor, at the college level. So it's okay. I mean, for part-time, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
But also, those are just the hours that I was in front of the class. Mm-hmm. Those, the hours that you're working and planning and prepping and grading, those are free. Those are free to the school. You know, those are, you do those. That's on your own time. So they
don't pay you for the background stuff.
No. I mean, I suppose it depends on what school you're at. You might have some office hours or something, but at this small school, we did not. So, I mean, like I said, my hourly rate was good, but then there's all the other extra stuff. And so I tried to do that while I was teaching, but also you got to be present while you're teaching. So, it's a balance.
I guess you didn't feel like, did you feel like there was a huge barrier to reach to just go on your own, or you were just like...
Boy, I will admit, I did not know what I was getting into. It was sort of a leap of faith. And I think that being able to do the neighborhood kids classes in my own studio was sort of like a little bit of a tiny safety net in my back pocket. So at least there was something coming in to balance out, how am I going to sell pot? Like everyone has mugs. How am I going to sell? I really didn't know
training the self-teaching people. Classes are, those are like paid, like they pay you for those.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Was it like a group rate? Like, hey, everybody, I'm doing like a group class, or was it individual?
I think it was individual. So I had a class that would be once a week, and it would be like, I don't recall, maybe 6-8 weeks, whatever, over the summer, something like that. And it was X amount of dollars for the whole class. And okay. I don't recall what it was. Maybe it was 100, 150. I really don't know. Cause this was probably 10, 12 years ago. So I've forgotten, but, it was enough to make my time worth my while and not be crazy expensive for the students, but also like heck of a lot cheaper than any other classes, and right in my town. So there's a lot of local people who are like, yay, we don't have to leave town.
Yeah.
Walk the kid down the street. So the question was like, how did I price that? Yeah. So it was per person per class.
Yeah. I was trying to ask, like, I guess, well, I mean, we've talked about this before because, like, we've chatted before, but you're not, like, a super money-driven person.
No.
But I guess I'm trying to see if there was some sort of, like, okay, like, I have these classes, so, like, I'm good to leave my job. Like, did you feel a sense of that, or you were just like, get to make money with it at all, like, I'm happy?
Yeah, it was a little experimental. I thought, well, I'll at least have a little bit from the classes I'm teaching out of my own studio, and I'll try to start selling some sculpture and pottery and maybe do other things. I mean, that was always like, I could always do something part-time or fill the gap with something. I really wasn't exactly sure what it was going to look like, but I just sort of had to jump in with both feet and make it happen. And word of mouth was really, really helpful. Like I said, small town living, everyone hears about you. And then, and I have friends who have a little boutique nearby, and so they started representing me, and then it just kind of grew from there. And so within a couple months, I was no longer teaching the classes in my studio because I was swamped with work. So it happened quite fast.
And all of those first clients were people that you knew in person and from your town?
At the very beginning, I should have written it all down. At the very beginning, it was people I knew. And then it grew, then people would come into that shop, or they would see me online. I did Instagram in the, earlier days. So it was earlier to grow. People found me, and people found me at, I started doing fairs, like I said, the craft fairs, and people find you there, and then they follow you, and it kind of organically grows. I never advertised. I just kept doing and doing and doing. And I'm not super financially driven. I would love to have more money, that would be great. And life would be much
easier. That's why you got to get on TikTok.
But I am very, I'm very driven just to make things. And I have that internal drive within, like I'm always doing something. I'm always making things and have a plan for the next thing. So I guess at this point,
did you have any other like thing that you wanted to do? You're just all in, like, as long as I get to make money off of pottery, I'm good.
I was pretty pottery focused. I had a time where I was doing some drawings that I had represented in a different gallery nearby. And that was very satisfying, but the drawings, they're silver point. I don't know if you're familiar with silver point, but you're drawing with sterling silver on a gesso prepared paper, and it takes forever. It is labor intensive.
Yeah. Sounds like
very,
it.
You can get very detailed. I mean, it's like, it's a dream for me because I like to just really, you know, get in there. So that was really fun, but you know, I will say it's a lot harder for someone to buy something to hang on their wall because you have to have room for it. And I, you know, maybe I've spent 20 hours on this drawing. Well, I have to reap those 20 hours. And then this drawing that's this big has to cost so much money, and someone has to fall in love with that and put it on their wall, right? Yeah. It's much easier to sell mugs and bowls. They cost a lot less. So I'm making less per item, but people can buy them more readily.
It seems like you can get a good rhythm going and just like be making a lot of them as well, where like a drawing is like that's it, you're just working on that, where mugs
that
you can
one,
work on a lot.
Yeah, exactly. So it'd be one drawing in a week versus, you know, 60 mugs in a week, or you know, whatever I happen to do. So it's easier to make more. The income is very different, you know, for a fine art. You know, you go to a gallery, the paintings are very expensive, that's why. Yeah. And you have to fall in love with it. You have to have the room in your home to put it on your wall. Well, everyone's got availability for a mug or a bowl or a oil cruet. You know, it's a lot less intensive an agreement to come to. Like you can just buy that. And so what that meant for me is that I'm able to sell a lot more, and then the word spreads more. And so that part of it has been very exciting. And like I said, I didn't know how it was going to all turn out. That part was great. My husband and I still say, I can't believe how many mugs people buy.
Yeah, so you definitely mugs. Have a good, a pretty like well-oiled machine, I feel.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel like I still say, I feel like I'm getting
still
there.
Still need to do the TikToks. I know.
You're going to make me do it.
I feel like that's like the place to be for the type of like stuff that you're doing. So what is the, like your gross income for your business look like right now, basically?
Currently. So last year was a little bit less because I took basically 2 months off. I had a surgery. So that had an impact, but normally I'd say it's a right around 50,000 annually. Okay. And last year was closer to 40. I just working on the taxes, I don't recall, but something like that. So you know, I'm certainly not rolling in the bucks, considering the hours that I put in.
What percentage of that would you say is like expenses, like materials, clay, all that kind of thing?
Gosh, I could have looked and seen that. I am able to write off quite a bit. I don't know.
Estimates are good, by the way. Like, you don't have to tell me, like, oh, it's...
Well, less... Oh, I would tell you. I just don't know. I'm not good with numbers. That's why I make things out of mud. I write off less than half of my income, if that helps. But I do write off quite a bit because I write off, you know, the clay expenses and the glazes. I write off my mileage. And
yeah,
I write
that's
off
what
my...
I assume is that, like, clay, paint, all the tools, like you have like a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, like the year I bought my big kiln was for a little over $4,000. So write off that and then amortize it over the years. So that gets you write off a little bit more. But the one really big thing we're able to write off is my studio space. And because it's such a good size studio in Washington State, you can write off your home office or studio or whatever it is, up to 25% of the cost of your home. And so I write off 25% of my mortgage and my heat bill and my, you know, everything, my insurance. Well, I have a separate insurance account, but I get to write that off because it's all connected into my home space. But it's my business. So that makes a huge difference. And you know what, that whether or not I had a business here or whether or not I was making very much money, I'd still get to write off that same amount. So, you know, having a tax person that knows how to do, you know, what to do, that helps.
Hire a tax guy.
Yeah. Well, and actually we did, my husband and I did it on our own for years, and it's grueling with small business, and I'm doing wholesale and I'm doing retail, and there's tax and fruit. Oh my gosh, it was insane.
And there's probably a bunch of like mini expenses on just programs that you pay for and things like that.
Yep. Well, and then when we realized we could have the tax person do this, and we still have to gather all the stuff, you still have to do what you're doing, you just have someone else finalize it. But then also you get to write that tax person off too. So that comes off your income. I'm like, okay, wait, I can pay someone and it comes off my cool. So, you know, the things you learn when you go into business by yourself accidentally.
So I guess let's talk about a topic that I find super interesting, which is, if I recall, you've been in Washington State your entire life, right?
Pretty much. When I was born, my parents were in Tennessee until I was about 3 and a half and moved back, but I don't really remember it. So essentially I've been here my whole life. Although I do come up with a good Southern drawl every now and then since I learned to talk when I lived in Tennessee. So yeah, I'm a Seattleite. My parents are from here. We're very sunk in.
So how have you dealt with the, I guess, explosion of costs in Seattle? Like, part of the reason that I did not like Seattle personally was how expensive it is.
Like, it's very expensive. Yeah.
So how have you juggled that? Because I think we were talking like that where you bought your house, basically, like that used to be a pretty affordable area. Like, how have you dealt with the explosion of cost, the explosion of people moving there, the tech boom?
Yeah, well, so we are, like I said, we're across the water, so we're near Seattle. We're not right in Seattle, but there are many tech people who live out in this area, especially now that people don't have to commute. You can work online. A lot more people live out here now, which has made prices go up even more because it's opened up our very, you know, suburban/rural area to the tech people downtown. So that has made prices jump. We bought our house 15 years ago, and we actually bought it during, like, right after the bubble burst in 2008.
Yeah, so you probably got a great deal on it.
So we got a good deal. It was also, without going into too much detail, it was
Please don't. You don't have to disclose your...
Oh no, I don't. That's not the price. It's the, like, it was hard. It was lived in hard, and we had to do a lot of work on the house.
Yeah.
So it actually couldn't be listed. Yeah. Oh, beyond. Yeah. So that made it even more affordable. And again, since my husband's capable of doing all the building and repairing, and, you know, we did some stuff, we hired people for some stuff. So that helped us a lot. You know, I mean, we are a teacher, an artist, whichever I was at the time. Yeah. And my husband works for the county. He works for King County. And so he's not paid like a tech worker, and I'm certainly not paid like a tech worker. So we have to be smart about what we do. We have to you know, pay attention to our finances and what we buy, and know that we're in it for the long haul. So, I mean, what we did when we bought our house was a great, you know, it worked out great, but not everyone can buy a house like this and fix it up, you know, and then improve it. So that's what we were able to do.
So in that vein, I guess, like, what would you do or what would you say to somebody that's in your position now, but the cost of living is like absolutely off the walls? And would you, I guess, like, would you try to adjust your business? Like, would you try to raise your prices? Like, what kind of moves would you make if you were starting now? Or would you, or do you feel like you'd feel less secure in pursuing art?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, as far as, you know, like raising prices, I think when you're starting out, you sort of have to have a more reasonable price. You have to undercut prices a little bit. I see a lot of people who are starting out and they price their mugs like people have been selling for 20 years. And it's like, oh, that mug, you're not ready.
Yeah.
Not ready for that. So well, I don't think that's a good way to do it.
The cost of living is so crazy. They have to make it make sense with the numbers.
Yes, but you also have to put your time in and work on your craft. You can't just decide you want the money for a piece that doesn't have good craftsmanship. So, I mean, that's my personal opinion, I suppose. People do it. but, you know, I put my time in. I mean, I've been doing pottery for a long time. Even when I started, my pots weren't as good as they are now because I had done it forever, but doing it on a daily basis really makes it better. So what else would I tell someone starting out? I would say to build
a
home
job.
Studio, possibly get a side job, but one that where you're networking. Like, so for me, teaching was good. If you're working in a gallery, that's great. Or in a museum, you know, something in the arts that you're contributing and connecting with people is a great way to do it. Not just because of the networking and where your pieces are going to end up, but what you're going to learn, what you're going to get out of it. So I think that, you know, if you do have a side gig to make it something that is worthwhile to your goals. So your side gig should not probably be working at Dairy Queen if you want to be an artist. It should be, you know, even if you're you're making minimum wage, working at a gallery, working in retail, you know, just to make it
Trying to work with the people
applicable.
Who are doing the thing that you do or that you want to do.
And doing something that's inspiring you rather than tiring you so that it doesn't take away from your goals, so that it contributes to the big picture idea. So that's what I would say. And I would say as far as building an in-home studio, highly recommend. There's a lot of, you know, you can go to public studios, and I think there's definitely, that's wonderful. Great place to get inspiration, again, connect with people. But when you start to get really serious, I feel like I need my own space. Like I want to be in charge of my space and know what's coming and going and knowing how I'm firing and I'm not messing, you know, someone else's piece isn't going to blow up in the kiln. And if you can start small, you can put your wheel in the laundry room. You can put your wheel in the garage, or your painting studio in the garage, get some good lighting, get a space heater and make it happen. I mean, when I originally started this studio, I didn't have running water. I potted up here for 2, maybe 3 years without running water. I had a bucket. I would bring it up from the house because I wanted hot water because it was cold up here. And then I would put it in like a big jug with a spigot, so it almost acted like running water. And then it would drain into my sink, which I didn't have any drainage. So it would drain into another bucket. And at the end of the day, I'd bring that bucket outside and I'd like filter it, you know, I'd let it dry off and put the water in the yard and the clay in the garbage or I'd recycle the clay, whichever. But so you can start with very little.
Would you have maybe considered leaving Washington or just being in another, like, I guess more affordable place, or would you have no matter what just made it work in Washington, like if you were starting now?
I don't know. We hadn't really considered leaving Washington because we're both from here, we have family here. There's less family here now, so we're sunk into our lives. We love, you know, our lives and our community and the people around us. But as I get older, I can see living anywhere, honestly, anywhere. Anywhere in the country, anywhere on the planet, especially temporarily. I'd love to go live somewhere else for 2 years. Somewhere warm for sure. But with clay, you have to learn the clay body that's in the area and then how your glazes or the glazes that are available in the area are going to react to that clay body. So it's like starting from scratch.
Yeah, because like I guess the one barrier that I see for most people is like, especially somewhere like Washington, is just how difficult it would be to balance wanting to do something creative and wanting to do art with the cost of living where mm-hmm. it's at. So I don't know. I guess like mm-hmm. that's a tough part, I feel.
Yeah. No, it's definitely a consideration. There are a lot of artists in my community, and that might be because this, you know, was a more rural area and easier to purchase back in the day. It's a little harder now, so things are changing. But the other thing is, you know, since there are so many people with money in the area who are driving, you know, they're driving the, yes, exactly. They might be driving up the mortgages, the house prices, but they are also shopping. And so, you know, I'm very thankful for people who prioritize and buy handmade, because that's what makes my business happen.
So we always talk about this, but what would you say to somebody that is like, why would I spend on a custom mug when I could go to Target and get a mug for $20?
Exactly. Or $10 even. You know, I'm sure most of us have a $10 mug in our cupboard. I happen to have a lot of really nice mugs, and I have so many of them, not just mine, but other potters that I know and I've collected, that I've made a mug wall, which is now basically like an art installation in my house. Why would you spend more? Because it feels good in your hand, because this handle was made by a human's hand to fit in your hand rather than a machine. And this mug was made to fit and hold, you know, hold and be cozy. And for those of us who love our coffee or tea, that's a big part of our lives. The way you wake up every morning and you snuggle your coffee cup and you like slowly start to, you know, become one with the world or not. Those are important times. Like, it's a busy, crazy world we live in. And if you can find, you know, a little small pleasure that is cozy and makes you happy.
Yeah.
It means everything. So, and then there's a lot of people who just want to support artists like myself, an artist's way of life. And they don't want the entire community to be crazy, busy, insane. They like the idea of the, you know, the romantic idea of the artist's life, which I'm living. But I can only do it if people are buying. And
yeah.
And I think people know that. People love going to markets in the summertime and before Christmas and meeting the person who made their wares, you know, handmade clothing, jewelry, mugs, whatever. People love that. And to talk to the person who made it and have a connection in this world of, you know, online, not quite connections, and to have that personal interface, it's very meaningful. So I think as our world changes, maybe those kinds of small, important things become more important or become more meaningful. So
would you say that you find like a lot of your customers being people who are interested in supporting arts, or like mainly interested mm-hmm. in supporting artists? Because like, I guess they feel like you took the plunge to do it.
I think so. But then there's people too who they're, you know, maybe that's not in the forefront of their mind to support the artist. They just want some cool stuff.
They just
stuff.
Want a cool mug. Yeah.
Because you go to a craft show and man, there's some cool stuff there. There's a lot of, you know, creativity and stuff that's not the same as everything on the shelf at Target. So yeah, there's, you know, there's room for everything in our lives. But I think that there's a lot of people who appreciate the real handmade quality of things. And, you know, when you use things like specifically, well, you know, to my world, things in your kitchen, you know, a bowl that you're holding that fits in your hands just right, or, you know, and looks so elegant on your table rather than some, you know, a piece of plastic, you know, it's just, it's a little bit more that wholesome feeling that we want our homes to be like. We want, you know, your home is your palace. You want it to be nice. You want it to be relaxing. You want to surround yourself with beauty. So that is what I think people are looking for when they're, or that's why they would buy something handmade, pay the extra dollars versus buying something at Target, you know. And we all have things where we make choices. I have items that I buy on Amazon and Target, just like everybody else. But I do
shipping
try.
Gets everybody.
Yeah. Oh, it does. Yeah. And boy, I feel that when people are like, what? How long does it take to make this? But, you know, we all, I guess it's a balance of, you know, where you're going to save that money. Like I said, we have to be financially responsible. And where you're going to put that money into something that is going to really make you happy and last for a very long time. And it's going to be something that you keep. So that's sort of the handcrafted vibe.
Where do you think that you could see, like, if in order to grow your business, like, what kind of stuff would you get into? Would you consider a storefront? Are you just kind of trying to stick to online sales and maybe, like, get on TikTok and and promote on there? Or, like, where could you see yourself going to continue growing?
To continue growing, what I'd like to do, I really would like to do more online sales. I had during COVID, during the shutdown, online sales were fantastic. You know, interestingly, I was, you know, just like everybody else, I thought, well, there goes my business. I'm going to go out of business. And because people aren't working and shopping. Well, people were shopping online like crazy. So that worked out for me. I feel guilty and strange to say so, but it worked out nicely for me. A lot of people discovered me at that point. Now that people are back to shopping in stores, I'm doing more through my boutiques and galleries, but then they take a bigger cut, right? If I sell it online, the proceeds come to me. If I sell it through the gallery, they take usually half, sometimes a little bit less, but it's a big markup. You know, on the other hand, there's like, I can make 40 mugs and just drop them off and not think about them again. They're going to sell them. Whereas I sell 40, I got to ship them. And, you know, so there's balance there too. But if I were to grow my business, I would want to do more online sales and focus on that more. And I, you know, honestly, I frustrate myself to say this, but I've just been too busy to focus on how to get the online sales to be a bigger percentage of my business.
Because you don't want to be on Etsy or Amazon or any of that?
I'm on Etsy just so people can find me there. And then I try to, you know, convert them to my website because that's the smarter thing to do. And
of course,
and actually it's better pricing.
I hear that Etsy
too.
Takes like a really sizable cut.
I mean, it's not as much as a gallery, but they sort of nickel and dime you. And the biggest thing about Etsy is you don't own your customer list. You don't have access. I mean, you could message someone, but when people shop through
who purchased it.
Well, I know who purchased it, but I can't like send out a newsletter unless they're my own customer. They've got to come to me and then I can send them a newsletter.
Put a card with a QR code on the thing.
Yep. Yep. That's when you sell. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, so online sales is definitely, you know, increasing that is what I would like to do. But I, you know,
I've seen some crafters, some like on Amazon. Is that something, but you're just,
you know, I've thought about it. I do have a fellow potter friend who's on Amazon and she said it was like huge for her business. And it really has worked out for her well. So it is an option. I feel like it's a little bit like Etsy in that it's another
control.
Supplier. Yeah, yeah. And unless they then convert to you, but it's a route I could go. I think better SEO is probably something that would work for me more than just putting myself out there on another platform. I think really kind of dialing in what I've got going and doing that kind of work is not very fun for me. So
one aspect from Amazon that I think is cool though is that they, I believe, you ship them like everything and they handle the individual shipments, which is kind of nice, I feel, because you don't have to do the individual packaging.
Right. So I could just, they would just market what I have available.
They just hand, I think you just do one large shipment and they handle the like actual sending out of stuff. But I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you think about a storefront? Like just being in some downtown and getting a storefront?
I sort of have little fantasies about it, but I don't really want to do it. So here's what that looks like. When we go on vacation and I go to a seaside town or we take a day trip somewhere and there's cute boutiques and shops and I'm like, oh, I could do this. Or when we retire, we could live upstairs in the apartment above the shop and then I could sell here. You know, of course I wouldn't be retired. Yeah. And I could make my pieces here and just have, but I don't want to manage a store. And then you have to have other things. You
get some team to do it.
I know. It's just, what it comes down to is like, I just want to make pots. I don't want to do all the rest of it. And there is more that goes with it. You know, no matter how you manage it, there's more that goes with it. So it's a possibility, especially if we do end up moving somewhere warm to do something like that.
So that is something you're looking at, somewhere warm.
It's a you never know. It's a possibility. I mean, I didn't know I would be doing this, to be honest. So it could happen. And I love the idea of just having people, you know, walking by as they're on vacation going, oh, how sweet. Let's grab that.
And, yeah. I feel like I've definitely done that where I've seen some shop and I'm like, oh, let me walk in there. And then you end up just buying something, even though you didn't intend to. So I feel like that's also an avenue of just having foot traffic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My husband and I, maybe 2 years ago, we went on vacation in California and there's this cute little studio, retail space for sale with an apartment above. And,
oh, there's tons of stuff.
And I was like, this great picture window with the big shelf on it. And I'm like, I could put my wheel in the window and throw in the window. I mean, forget TikTok. Oh, I'd be doing it live.
Yeah.
And people would be,
I feel,
you know,
like people would totally
watching that. And I was like, okay, this is my business model right here. But you know, then it's you gotta have people do all the other parts and pieces. And because I can't throw pots all day long.
Have you seen a painting with
sometime.
A twist?
Mm-mm.
A painting with a twist. I think I forgot where I've seen them, but basically it's like people, they give you wine and stuff. So it's like a hangout thing. And then you paint. And then there's
and
like
they
an
teach
instructor.
You, like, what to,
yeah. But you're like, it's like you could do like a pottery, like, and just teach people, but like maybe have it be like a girls' night out kind of thing. And
girls' night out, yeah, girls' night outs are great selling tools.
Yeah, I feel like you could spin that in a way where like you just have people coming in and just to hang out.
Yeah, well, and where I am is definitely not that. I mean, I am, you've been here, I am off the beaten path for sure.
I'm saying like if you have the storefront, then you could do that.
If I have
stuff.
A storefront, right. So that would be a whole different, whole different model. And so maybe when I'm tired of doing production and making as fast as I'm making these days, because at some point I'm going to be exhausted from it and I might want to change my model. So who knows? The world's a big place. I don't know what, I don't know. On the other hand, I also see us living here forever. So,
Well, there's a
hard to
just
say.
Take the ferry and find some cute spot in the downtown.
Yep, downtown Seattle. Oh, but then I got a commute. Oh, I got a great commute right now.
Yeah, your commute is just walking.
My commute is walking from my back door to my studio. It's pretty great. Yeah. So
run in that vein. Run me through just a regular day in the life, like a Tuesday. Like what does an average day look like for you?
So an average day for me, I will start out by saying I am a night owl, and so my days start a little bit late. I get up when I wake up and I mosey on out to the studio, and sometimes I start working at 9:30, sometimes I start working at noon. It's
the freedom,
whatever. A lot of freedom after being on a teaching schedule. It's really nice. And it just works for me personally. I'm just, no matter what I do, I'm up late and I sleep late. It's better. So, and I still end up working, 8, sometimes I'll work a 6-hour day. Sometimes I'll work a 12-hour day. Like, but you know, it averages out to about, you know, 8 hours a day.
But you're your own boss, so but you just have the freedom. It's just
usually on my schedule, you know, and then I go in and I have lunch when I want it, which is usually like 2 or 3 o'clock. And then I come out and I work some more and I eat dinner maybe around 8, sometimes 7, if my husband's like really hungry and starts making. But so in an average day, I will, you know, I switch days. Like one day I'll throw pots, and then the next day, and then I set them on the shelf and they dry overnight. And the next day I trim them, add handles if they're mugs, set them on the shelf to dry. And then I start that, you know, so I do that process every other day, basically, unless I'm glazing, in which case I won't be making something that day, you know, throwing. I will be doing glazing, you know, if I unload a kiln, then I glaze. And sometimes it takes me a day, day and a half to glaze a full load. Depends on if it's a little bit more extensive. It'll take me sometimes 3 days to glaze, which I always forget how long glazing takes. And then
having
I go
done
back
it for 20 years.
Yeah. Like sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm just going to glaze today. I'm like, oh my God, I'm on day 3 of glazing. What is happening? It just depends on what I'm making and, you know, how streamlined the work is, basically. Yeah. I do also have an assistant who works for me, and she comes one or two, lately she's been coming 2 mornings a week, and she's here like 2 or 3 hours. And she helps me with glaze prep. So she does some of the stuff that's like, you know, sponging, painting some of the color onto the, I have stuff in my mug, so I can't, the bottom.
Yeah,
the spill my tea. Yeah, she, you know, paints that on and then sponges it off, and so, and then I do the glazing, but she does the prep stuff for me, and that's abundantly helpful. So she's, you know, then I also have to coordinate when things are happening when she's here, when I'm unloading the kiln. And
how'd
so
you
how'd you find her? She's a neighbor of mine, and she is a mom, and she worked for another neighbor of mine up the hill. And that neighbor was changing her business, and so I knew she was available. And lots of mutual friends, and I was like, "Hey, do you, you know, are you interested in a couple hours? It's you know, it's like studio assistant work. And nothing glamorous. It's messy, but it's, you know, a lot of like repetitive tasks and shipping. She handles most of my shipping. And she was like, yeah, she walks here. She lives like 2 blocks from me. And, you know, so it works into her. She has a couple different part-time jobs where she does that, and it works into her lifestyle to be able to like coordinate when her kids need to drive and that she can just walk up here. And so,
you know,
it would be hard for me to
like
hire someone. Yeah. And I mean, someone's not going to come from Seattle to come to work here, you know, with the cost of the ferry. So, you know, the way we all work in small towns is a little bit different. But yeah, oh, I'm so glad she's here, and we have, you know, we chat. So at least I get to talk to someone once in a while, because I'm pretty much a shut in here in my studio. So
how do you stay motivated since you don't really have like a boss or, I mean, I guess yeah. there's deadlines in terms of shipping and stuff, but for the mm-hmm. most part, you kind of just have to motivate yourself. So how are you doing that?
That's just where I'm very driven. To make myself do more. And probably I could throw more in a day, but then I have to finish more the next day. That's a kind of a constant battle I'm always doing. I did that earlier this week. I threw twice as many mugs as I normally do because I finished. And I was like, oh, I got time. I'll do another bag of clay. And then, you know, the next day I was like, I can't put handles on these all in one day. So a lot of it's like knowing how to balance, you know, what works for me personally. But I'm just motivated to make more. And, you know, right now I'm still trying to get caught up after the holidays. But even, you know, when I'm caught up, when I have, you know, stock, and then I start to think, oh, I've got to work on the sculpture that I've had an idea for that I haven't had time to do because I've been making so many pots. So motivation isn't an issue with me. I love to create. And to make and to do. And sometimes, you know, even on a weekend, I'll be like, huh, what am I doing? Like, if I'm not doing anything, like I used to be able to like sit and hang out and read or go to the beach. Now I'm like, oh, I gotta go out to the studio. And I, like, it's hard for me to not work. I'm a little bit of a busybody in that way, but also, like, I love what I do. Like, I, you know, I'm making pots. It's so fun.
So why you don't try to set boundaries on the weekends, or do you have like a set day off where you're like, I'm not touching a mug today?
No, I mean, no, sometimes, you know, we'll try to make plans and do something and then I'm not in the studio, of course, but if nothing's happening, why don't I come up here? It's, you know, it's a great place to be.
So you just really love what I love what doing.
Love what I do. I mean, people pay money to do pottery. So
that's true. That's
I make money doing pottery. Yeah. It's pretty good balance. So
what would you say to a young artist that wants to make art their business? Like, what would your main piece of advice be?
Well, probably a good piece of advice is to figure out your business model and like what pieces you're going to be making, how you're going to be marketing, where you're going to be selling. But I did none of that. So it's good advice, but I don't know
it.
Exactly. you know, have an idea for sure. I had an idea, but I certainly didn't have anything written out to give a bank to get a loan. I just started doing it. So I guess, you know, and if you're driven to continue to create, it's gonna work out, because then you're gonna have all these things and you gotta sell them, you know. And I'm driven to like put myself out there to the world so people know they're available. If you're the kind of person who's like, I don't know what I want to make today, that's not gonna work, you know. If you a lot of artists will wait to be inspired before they start their work. I mean, that doesn't work if you're doing it.
I don't think that ever works.
Especially if you're in production, you got it. Yeah, you got it. Like, chop chop, let's go.
Because I would find, so, I feel like that's a trap, and I would find myself in that trap where I'd be like, oh, I'll do that passion project when I'm inspired. But like, the inspiration never comes. You have to just like force yourself to just do it. And then it might be horrible, but just like when you get from point A to point B, and then just force yourself to do the next one. And then you just force yourself till eventually you just get good.
Yeah, the idea is the inspiration. So then don't wait. Like, take it and run, you know? Just do it. I'm making so many mugs right now that I'm not doing a lot of other projects on the side that are creative, in terms of like sculptures that are, you know, more unique. I do a couple a year. It's kind of all I have time for. And I love doing them, but then when I do them, I'm like, oh gosh, I could be making a whole bunch of mugs right now. So I sort of, you know, I thought I wanted to do more sculpture and less production. Now that I'm doing production pots, I never meant to be a production potter. I love it. I absolutely love it. So people are like, don't you get tired of making the same shape? You know, nope. No, it's super fun.